Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software, or are interested in finding a great place to work, do check out their links in the description below. My guest today is a senior principal software engineer at Red Hat. Before joining Red Hat, she worked at IBM as a full-stack Java developer, a WebSphere Liberty build architect, a client-facing consultant, a JVM performance engineer, and as an innovation leader. She led the developer community in the IBM garage for several years and became a bit of a methods geek. During her time in the IBM garage, she led projects for enormous banks, tiny startups, and everything in between. She's used the cloud to understand climate risks, count fish, help a blind athlete run ultra marathons in the desert, and invent stories, although not necessarily all at the same time. She's an Oracle Java champion, an IBM Q ambassador, and a Java 1 rock star. In her spare time, she's a successful author and regular keynote speaker. Please welcome Holly Cummins.
Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us here today, Holly. Let's start off with an easy one. What's the future of coding, and is it getting harder?
Oh, see, you say that's the easy one, and I think that's the hardest one. It's always such a terrible risk to make these kinds of predictions, because you just know in, you know, 2 years or 5 years, you're going to look back and go, oh, no, I couldn't have been more wrong. I should just, you know, hang up my hat. But right now, you know, it's such a period of enormous change, and the pace of change is so rapid. But I think... and I could be wrong, lots of caveats. I think the change isn't as big as it seems. And I think we can put what's happening now in terms of how our job is changing on a continuum that's really been since the start of computers. We've been going higher and higher and higher up the stack. And yeah. Each time we've gone up the stack, the people who had trained on the previous level of the stack have said, this is terrible. The next generation aren't going to have the skills. They're not going to know how it works. And really, you know, they're just not as good as me, and everything's going terrible. And, you know, we've been doing that for 70 years. And I think we're probably going to be able to continue doing that for another 70 years. I wouldn't want to predict what the change after the current horizon is, but it feels like the fundamentals of our job aren't really typing, and what we type and the speed with which we can type has changed, but all of the stuff around it, like talking to people, figuring out what we're supposed to be doing, yeah, getting out of bed in the morning, which is a particular challenge for me, you know, all of that is is the same.
I wonder if it's a common feature of software developers that they don't like getting out of bed early in the morning. It's certainly true of me. I agree entirely. I think I would phrase it quite similarly as well, to be honest. So we're talking about changes that gradually raise the level of abstraction with which we can instruct a computer to do something useful. And it feels to me, and it sounds like it feels to you, that we are either there or at least on the verge of the kind of change that is going to significantly change that level of abstraction with which we can address a computer and get it to do useful work. But that doesn't do away with the need for the real work, which the real work is the problem solving.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be optimizing for typing. We should be optimizing for thinking, and getting good at that. It seems. So the idea of assembler programmers calling COBOL programmers lazy and not real programmers is the same one that we have when we say, you know, people using AI to write all their code are not real programmers or whatever. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and you see it, you know, sort of about for computer languages, and you also just see it in human nature. I can't remember the exact quote, but there's the wonderful Roman quote, isn't there, where they're saying, "Oh, you know, the teenagers of today, they're just not like the teenagers that they used to be. You know, they show no respect, and they're just really terrible." And you know, this is something that we've just been going through over and over again.
Absolutely. So do you have a view of where that raising the level of abstraction is likely to go?
I mean, that's an interesting one, because it does, it's probably, you know, my little mind just can't conceive, but it feels like we're getting so close to natural language now, and that's kind of been the target for a long time. So, you know, we had assembler, and well, first of all, we had, you know, just the switches, and there were zeros and ones, and then we went to assembler, and it was amazing. This kind of looks like words. And then we went to COBOL, and it looked more like words. And then we went to the higher level languages, and it, you know, had long variable names and that kind of thing. And now we're sort of further up, and it feels like we couldn't get any more abstract, but I'm sure that's just the sort of the blinkers that I have. But it's also in we I also wonder whether we might go back in the other direction a little bit. So we're sort of pursuing natural language, but we've in the past we've experimented with things that we thought were going to be really expressive and really natural, and they actually turned out to not be as good an idea. So sometimes we see this a little bit sometimes, you know, with something like Copilot, where you have to write such a long comment to prompt it that you think, actually, this was a lot of words. I could have just typed the stuff more quickly than I could have written this prompt. And we did when we did model-driven development, you know, that was the sort of the rage 20 years ago. It felt so good and it looked so great in demos, because it was like, well, instead of, you know, writing all of this code, why don't we just draw a diagram? And then we realized that in order to specify the behavior, we had to like take that tiny little box and then like click on it and then put a whole bunch of code and then put a whole bunch of code somewhere else. And then trying to read the system and understand the system was a nightmare. And I think we're seeing that a little bit now with some of, so in terms of specifying it, we have to write the really long prompts. But then as well, there's this feature of the code that comes out of these systems, at least right now, which is that the way the systems are trained gives it a bit of a bias towards verbosity. So it writes more code than you need. And we get really excited by that, because I think we have a bias to verbosity as well, right? And we go, wow, it wrote a whole screen of code. This is amazing. You know, when I commit this, I'm going to look really productive. And actually, we spend such a small amount of our time writing code and such a large amount of our time reading code that at that point, then it's the higher, well, the move to natural language and the move to this kind of programming has possibly made us less productive in the long run. Although now I sound like, you know, the people who say, oh, COBOL is going to make you less productive. If you don't know assembler, you just, you know, it's going to bite you in the long run.
It's difficult to find the line, because I value the fact that I think of myself as a natural skeptic. Any idea, even the ideas that I like, I look at and think, can that be right? It's probably wrong. And it's the way that I approach ideas. And so I believe that this is going to be the next step in abstraction in terms of programming. But I don't think that we're there yet. And I think that a lot of the problems that you're talking about are similar to things that we've seen before. But I have more belief that this time this might work.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's really easy, you know, as a sort of a grumpy old person to look at the sort of the flaws in the current thing and say, oh, well, this is never going to work. But actually, a lot of those are fixable, like the bias towards verbosity, you know, that's clearly fixable. And I'm just thinking again about the sort of, you know, the future past the immediate future, which is so hard to visualize. But I wonder whether actually, you know, the sort of, I think the dream would be that kind of multimodal programming, wouldn't it? Like a really fluent multimodal programming where you would say, this bit, it feels most natural to me to express it as a bunch of boxes. So I'm going to do that. This bit I want to express in natural language. So I've got, you know, I've embedded my prompt into source control. This bit, actually, you know what? The variables in the math, I just want to do it old school, and that's going to be most effective. And at the moment, we really have to kind of choose.
I think there's one of the difficulties is it turns out that text and programming languages are quite good at being able to precisely represent ideas. actually, in many ways, much better than human languages are, which tend to lack precision. That precision, they tend to be, you know, more variable, more open to nuance and interpretation and all of those kinds of things. And I think that two-level idea is probably going to be part of the future and an interesting one. And maybe further, you know, pull the division between the kinds of programmers that are writing things, you know, to solve human needs and the kind of programmers that are writing things to make computers work better. We used to call them system programmers in the old days, but I haven't heard that term for a long time. But, you know, people writing operating systems and device drivers and things like that, I'm not sure how helpful AI is going to be in doing that for quite a while. All those kinds of trading systems that I was writing, the ultra high performance things, I'm not sure that's where it plays. But if you're writing a nice little mobile app for people to use, that's similar to other nice mobile apps, that's definitely rich territory for now.
But I think we might get two different kinds of assistance for those two scenarios. And I hadn't really thought about the different needs of those two communities before, but it makes total sense. And so the one really need to develop with speed and the other one need to develop with precision. But yeah. I think even for that system programming case, I think we will see a lot of useful AI tools in the area of analysis, because those code bases end up being potentially quite complex and quite hard to navigate. And so then you end up with the tools not to like write the code, but just to say, okay, well, where is this happening? And, you know, can you explain this code? And there, I think they can do interesting things. And we are already seeing the stories where, you know, people try it out for analysis and it comes back and they say, oh, well, no, this is stupid. It got it wrong. And then they look in more detail and they're like, oh, actually, my understanding of the system was wrong. It got it right. Yeah. At least some of the time.
Yeah. I think you and I share something of a background in high performance computing and an interest in that. And certainly I wonder whether that's an area where AI could imagine it helping with the mechanical sympathy, kind of saying, this is a dumb idea because you forgot that that's a block storage device that you're talking to, or something like that, you know, those sorts of ideas, just reminding us and giving us the information to guide us to better choices when we're solving problems. I could kind of imagine it doing that with the right kind of training, but an interesting problem. The other thing that strikes me and has been a bit of a hobby horse of mine recently is this idea of what the programming looks like for these systems. And one of the problems, it seems to me, is that we are at risk of giving up incrementalism. We AIs build code in such a different way. We humans, we kind of write small little changes and we evaluate after each change and kind of grow the system organically, or at least as far as I can see, the people that are good at it, that's the way that they tend to organize their work. And AIs seem to go bang and give you a whole load of code, and then bang for the same problem and give you a different load of code, unless you kind of turn those down. And even then, new version of AI might generate different code. So how do we, you know, the reproducibility seems interesting to me. So it seems that we still need some kind of formal language is probably the wrong term, but structured way of specifying the problem, even if it's in natural language. And I think that BDD might be a hint at what that looks like. Sort of specify very clearly what the requirement is, and then you can verify that the requirement is met with the test. You have thoughts on that kind of thing in terms of as a direction?
I'm thinking. I think there's like about three different ideas in there that are really interesting. One is, I think that BDD one, with BDD, you do end up sort of having, I always find that there's a slight gap again with BDD between the sort of the promise and then how it actually looks when you implement it. Because the promise is, you know, oh, we're going to be able to specify our system in a way that, you know, the business can do it. And then when you actually sit down to do it, you know, you find you have a small file that's the sort of the business readable text. And then there's this huge iceberg of how do I translate that business readable text into, you know, initializing my system and, you know, hooking all of the things together. And it might be that some of that gap could be something that, I mean, I was going to say maybe that would be something that LLMs could help us with, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily any more amenable to LLMs than any other coding task. But it fits well to the model of how we're using them now, which I guess is why the idea appeals, right? Which is I have this natural language specification and I just want to say that, and then all of the stuff to turn that specification into reality, which in this case is a reality of testing, gets done somewhere else. But I think that idea of incrementalism is really interesting as well. And that might be one of the reasons that the experienced programmers are sometimes uncomfortable with this system, is because it really upends our notion of what good looks like. Because we're so accustomed to, okay, here's how I do it, and here's how I can have these tiny little layers of change, and I can peel it back in source control. And it, as you say, it just blows all of that out of the water. And I think we don't yet know what good looks like for using this system. Do we have to try and like layer our prompts so that we can do it, you know, the same way as we're used to? Or is that just a really silly idea, like, you know, trying to make cars look like horse-drawn carriages? It, you know, we just need to change the model.
The other thing it seems to me is that that's kind of been the stumbling block at previous attempts, like model-driven architecture that you mentioned, of trying to raise the level of abstraction, is kind of the reproducibility. You know, what happens when the problem changes a little bit, or what happens when you find something's wrong? I want to go back to it and tweak it a little bit. It's that tweakability, it's the ability to make those small changes that I think that the good professional programmers maintain in terms of their design choices, their ways of working, and so on. And that's the thing that I think we're in danger of discarding. And if we do, that it seems to me that that will severely limit the impact that AI-generated code can have. So it's not that I'm against it. I'm for it if it can give the abstraction jump that we're talking about, but I think that's harder to achieve than just throwing an LLM at it and, you know, hoping that the fact that it can write FizzBuzz means that it can write anything else.
Yeah, I think there's sort of an open question still about what the optimum unit of delivery is, and that sort of comes back to some of these questions about and the tweakability and also the verbosity. You know, is the unit of delivery that I just check my prompts into source control and that everything else is just an implementation detail, or is the unit of delivery that I check the generated source code into source control and then it's up to me to manage this code that maybe isn't how I would have written it and that kind of thing, but at least then it does have all of the qualities of service that I used to want in terms of like, I can change this, I can understand it.
I think that's another interesting point, is that idea of the readability of the code. There have already been several examples where AIs have been communicating with each other, where they've invented new language, that their own languages, to exchange information much more quickly and much more efficiently between themselves. How long is it before we're not going to be able to even read the code that they write? I don't think that's very long at all. I think that's going to come quite quickly if we just let them write the code, and then we don't have the option. So figuring out ways to kind of retain some degree of control, I suppose, is an interesting challenge and an interesting problem. I don't want to dig us too deeply into an AI hole, but I thought it was an interesting place to start. One thing I want to throw at you, one of the things that I picked up from one of your presentations that I really liked was the idea of invalid magic. I wasn't quite sure whether that was related to AI programming or not, but it seemed relevant.
Yeah, that was I was sort of I was working away you know doing something on the internals of Quarkus, and I got this exception that said invalid magic. And When I dug into it, it was actually a little bit more mundane than it seemed. Because when I got that, I thought, well, this just sums up, all of my life with computers, really, isn't it? Is it that it promises this magic and then you get it wrong and it's invalid magic. But what it actually, yeah, to what it actually was is all Java class files have a magic sequence at the beginning, which is, OX Cafe Babe. And I had managed to generate a class file because I was doing terrible things to the class loader and everything. I had managed
As
to
you
generate
do,
it. Yeah. I had managed to generate a class file that had this invalid magic sequence. But yeah, the exception just made me laugh because that's
that's it.
increasingly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great error message. Some of my favorites, there used to be one on the BBC Micro that used to say silly.
That's fantastic.
And on the ZX Spectrum, which became an in joke in my family, and I still hear it occasionally, but M RAM top no good. But there you go. That's the problem of being a nerd, I suppose.
Yeah, and it gets even better, of course, once you have international developers, because we used to have an exception on a product I worked on, and it should have said that there was something wrong with the back end, but instead it said that there was something wrong with the backside, which in UK English means something quite different.
You've got lots of software develop English software developers smirking in the
Yeah,
corner, fiddling
yeah,
away. Yeah.
yeah.
So going back to the thing, the other aspect of the kind of future of coding that I kind of liked is it getting harder? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's certainly the breadth of we I think there's sort of these two, it's a hard question to answer because again there's sort of two contradictory developments. So one is that we're going further up the stack and we have this abstraction and I don't need to know assembler anymore and I'm very happy about not knowing assembler. But on the other hand, the breadth of what we need to hold in our heads is getting bigger and bigger. So it used to be that you needed to know assembler and then you needed to know just a few target systems that your assembler was going to, and that was it. But now, if you look at something like the CNCF cloud landscape, it just makes you want to cry, and then you laugh, and then you cry again. And with AI, we've got sort of a similar one. There's, I think it's called, oh, I can't remember what the acronym stands for. It's, I think, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and data landscape, which the acronym for that is the MAD landscape. And you look at it and it is the MAD landscape. So like the number of programming languages that we have to choose from is huge. So it used to be, you could know a programming language and you could be a COBOL developer. But now you can't just be, certainly not for a sustained period of your career, program just in one language. And even if you do program just in one language, all of the stuff around you, like the libraries and the frameworks, is just so huge. So like if you look at npm.org, in I think in like 2000 there was 1.2 million libraries there, and now there's like 2 million libraries. Like it's going up and up and up. And then the things that you knew have that another sort of challenge that we have as we're sort of going through this kind of middle stage of maturity as well is the abandonware. So you have the beautiful open source library and it solves your problem, and then you realize that it hasn't been updated for 5 years and it's stuffed full of CVEs and you need to rewrite to solve the same problem just because the landscape under you has crumbled slightly.
Yeah, I had that last problem very recently. I have a pet project, and there was this lovely little WebSocket open source project that I was using to do async communication to the web, and it stopped working in later versions of Java, and then it wasn't being maintained anymore. So I'm busy trying to see if I can find the time to rewrite it at the moment. But
Yeah,
it's yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
and
The
if you look at,
other thing that, sorry, go ahead.
sorry, I was just gonna say, if you look at like the business model of something like Red Hat or any open source company, it sort of seems like, well, how can you possibly make money selling software that is free and open source? And the value proposition, one is secure supply chain, but then the other part of the value proposition is that it doesn't go away like so much of the free as in beer stuff does.
It's a bit like having Patreon subscribers for my YouTube channel. The other thing that I think, the other aspect of this thing about it getting harder that I think is Interesting. So when I was writing my book on modern software engineering, I did a little bit of research that I intended to put in the book, but didn't make the book in the end. It didn't really fit in the right way. But I thought it'd be an interesting experiment to try writing a simple web app, kind of a straightforward CRUD style web app, in a modern, up-to-date tool set and stack, and in the technologies that I was using in the mid-1990s. And I did that, and it was about the 1990s version was about a quarter of the amount of code as the version that I wrote in JavaScript and Angular and all of those kinds of things, using Java and JSP and CSS and those sorts of JavaScript for the front end and those kinds of tools, versus a modern UI framework and all of that. It was more code, and it took me longer. Partly that was probably because I was more familiar with the 1990s version, but also it was more. There was just more stuff to deal with, and sure, I got more from it. It was better web browser neutral, I'm sure, than the code that I wrote, but we don't always make things easier, which seems silly.
Yeah, I feel really conflicted about this one because I've heard sort of I haven't seen the actual experiment, which is fascinating in terms of like how big that difference is. But you see this argument a lot, and you see it, for example, something like the React framework, where people go, "This is just so huge, it makes it big, it makes it harder. What problem were we even trying to solve?" And let's go back to HTML. And I think perhaps because I'm a natural optimist, I find it really uncomfortable, this idea that we're not making things better, even though there is evidence that we're not. And I think you're right that sometimes what we're getting is something that's more subtle. So we're getting, better security, or we're getting better browser, compatibility, or something like that. But yeah, it does seem that we try and make things better and we make it worse, which is just sad.
It seems to me it's the kind of complex adaptive system thing. You prod it in one place and it pops out in another, and all of those sorts of things. And that the pressures on a successful open source producer are kind of different. You want to keep releasing new stuff, and so you end up growing something like Spring, which I thought started out as a nice, simple thing. And now he's so massive and overcomplicated, I don't want to use it, to be honest. And that seems like a common sort of trend, very often. And I'm old, and so I have a limited memory these days. So I want stuff that's easy to think about. I want the surface area of, the tools that I use to be simple enough to help me, and no more complicated than that idea, ideally. Clever, but not easy to use.
Yeah, and simplicity is absolutely the hardest thing to achieve, and it's hard to achieve, and it's even harder to maintain, because you're right that there's always new feature requirements, there's just always this sort of, gravitational accumulation of cruft in both in a code base, but then also in the user interface. And I think what makes it hard to talk about simplicity is that there's sort of two kinds of simplicity, isn't there? So there's this sort of, I think, going back to that argument of I tried to do it the old way and it was much simpler, but was I actually doing a like for like equivalent? Sometimes you can do something where you say, okay, I've just re-implemented this, using basic HTML, using C, whatever, look how small it is. And you haven't implemented the same thing. You've just implemented the really naive equivalent that looks superficially the same but isn't. And that's sort of one argument about, oh, we need to be simpler. But then on the other hand, you do get the cases where the system is so elegant, and you do have something that did achieve everything that it needed to, and it did it while getting rid of a whole bunch of external complexity and a whole bunch of pitfalls for the user and that kind of thing. And I think that those systems are really, really fantastic.
So, I don't know whether this is an unfair question, but What sorts of techniques would you use to try and achieve that kind of elegant simplicity rather than stupid simplicity?
This is something that I've been thinking about a lot, partly just because it's an interesting question. But so one thing I've been thinking about is, you know, sort of in the context of my day job, which is Quarkus, and you know, we certainly believe that we've achieved something which, you know, is giving you that kind of double win where it's elegant and then it is easier to use and faster and better and all of that. But I think one of the ways that we did that is, which I think is totally generalizable, is to look for the assumptions that are no longer true. And then if you can carve out everything that's related to supporting this assumption that's no longer true, then things get a lot easier. So with Quarkus, for example, and you know, this is just one example of an assumption, Java used to be really heavily optimized for dynamism. So I used to work on OSGI, and with OSGI, the whole point, the problem being solved was, can I change the engine while the plane is flying? Mm-hmm. And now we're running in containers. You know, you should not be SSHing into your container to, you know, try and dynamically patch your Java runtime to like introduce new classes. You know, that is, you should be using CI because CI is a thing, and, you know, just rebuilding the whole thing. So all of this dynamism, there was, you know, in terms of the you know, the sort of the runtime complexity, there was a tax being paid for it. But then also in terms of just the sort of the architecture of the system and then the implications for how you programmed it, there was all this stuff related to dynamism that you just, in 98% of the cases, don't need. So if we get rid of that, then, you know, things become easier. And I think there's probably equivalent, you know, answers from like other things where we can just say, well, wait a minute, why are we even doing this anymore? Let's get rid of this. And then it just takes this sort of cascade of other crap that we didn't want along with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting idea. I've thought about something, a similar idea, I think, but from a slightly different angle. I was kind of quite influenced from a process point of view by lean ideas and the idea of trying to, you know, get more out for less work. And so I was trying to take work out of the process and driving it that way. And that feels to me like a very similar idea to what you're describing, is trying to find those ways in which, you know, we can remove stuff that we don't, you know, we remove those assumptions that we don't care about anymore. And it's again that part, you can't really predict those things. You know, as you say, the dynamism thing sounded like a decent, you know, a good idea at the time. Mm. And it's just turned out that it wasn't good enough to it wasn't as important as other things.
Yeah. Or it was necessary at the time, but the world changed.
Or the world, yeah. One of those things, absolutely. So, you know, we've got to kind of keep that focus. So one of the techniques that I think about and seems increasingly part of the way that I think about software development is to be much more strongly outcome focused and sort of designing from the outside in rather than the inside out, and thinking, you know, what's the minimum that a user of my software needs to do to achieve whatever it is that they want to achieve, and trying to make sure that I'm able to do that. I've always liked software that was doing clever things, but was easy to use. There was years ago a paint program called Corel Draw, which I thought was wonderful because it was elegantly simple, much simpler than others at the time, but you could do quite powerful things. And I've always liked that. Gradle is a good example of that. Gradle, I can have a one line build script if I want to take all of their suggestions. I just say, import Java or whatever the equivalent is, I can't remember now, but you know, it's a Java build, and then I could just take the defaults and it'll work. And I like that kind of that smartness, but I can override it and I can make it do smarter things, tailor it if I need to.
Yeah, I think that's another sort of Oh, I've got two things to say, so I need to remember. Because one, I think that outside-in perspective is so powerful, and I think, a really good team will have the combination of some people who are maybe outsiders, so then they can bring that outside-in perspective better, and then the people with the deep knowledge. Because I sometimes have with my team, a conversation where I say, well, let's make it work like this, because that's the nicest experience, and then my colleagues will say, well, that's nice, except it's impossible. And I'm like, okay, well, let's fix the fact that it's impossible. And then we can, because that's what it should be. And most things that seem impossible are fixable eventually. But I think that idea of extending and going past the simple is really important too. Because we have such a problem in our industry of kind of the demoware, don't we? Or the sort of the golden path, which is surrounded by barbed wire. And so, like, as long as you're on the golden path, you're like, oh, this is so great, this is so simple. And then you want to do one tiny little other thing, and then you spend, 3 weeks reading the user manual and like fighting it, and you can't. And so you need to have it so that the 80% of the use cases are really simple, and the other 20% of the use cases, they might not be easy, but at least they're possible.
It's, I've always thought of that as the kind of low code problem, or as it used to be called before low code, the 4GL problem. You kind of you build something that's good at building things in a niche, but half a step outside the niche, and it's either impossible or at least very hard. And there's a reason why general purpose programming languages are more popular. It's because they're general purpose, and we can solve any problem that you can think of pretty much. So related to that, it seems to me there was a presentation of yours that I watched, and you were talking about letting platforms do the work and abstraction being a good thing. That seems an important part of what we're talking about to me. Would
Yeah,
you
and I think,
agree?
yeah, definitely. And I think, and again, it's sort of, I think it relates to both of what we've talked about before, actually. So I think one thing is it relates to are things becoming harder or easier? And I saw that idea of letting platforms do the work in the context of shift left, because I think shift left is, it's such a good thing at an organ, at a sort of industry thing, because you definitely don't want that sort of model where you have your tiny little sphere and then you throw it over the wall to see if it actually works, because you don't know if it works, and then you throw it over the wall again to see if it's usable, because you don't know, and then you throw it over the fourth wall to see if it's secure, and then at this point you've gone over like five walls and you're no closer to delivering. So I think we've got to fix that. But then the implication of fixing that is that all of a sudden, as a developer, I also need to be a usability expert, and I need to be a QE expert, which is, QA is, it's not a trivial skill. It's not something that, we can just do because we're developers. And then I need to be a security expert, and that is like scary. And then all of a sudden, it comes back to this cognitive load of like, as a modern developer, I need to know so much. And so I saw as an alternative to shift left, shift down. So it's okay, we'll let the platforms do the work. But I think this then comes back to, if I am in this model where I'm letting the platform do the work, all of a sudden my platform's a lot bigger and it's a lot heavier. And then I might find myself going, well, wait a minute, why am I using this platform that I have to learn, and that itself brings a bit of a cognitive load, when I could just be doing things, the way I used to do it in the 1990s, and it's so much simpler. And it's like, well, and then so you have to hope that I'm paying this little bit of extra cognitive load for the platform and I'm getting a ton back, as opposed to I'm paying a lot of cognitive load for the platform and I'm getting a little bit back.
So I think that's a really nice way of thinking about it. But if I'm honest, probably most of the platforms that I see in the wild are more like your second example, where you get an awful lot of cognitive load for relatively little reward. So how do you design a good platform to overcome that, to get something that, what do you think the parameters are to make a platform give you that advantage?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a vanity in platform building, which I think is partly why we get so many, and then so many of them are quite so big. Because when I was a consultant, I would talk to so many organizations who would come in, and they'd be like, "Yeah, I'm going to build a platform." It's like, well, if all of you build a platform, then there's going to be one platform per organization, and then it's not a platform. Then it, I don't know what it is, a monoform or something. But and so I think it comes back to, again, that sort of radical simplicity, that finding the assumptions that allow you to actually have the outside in perspective, but then also being in contact with your users. So those kinds of things, they can't be built in isolation where we say, oh, I'm just going to build a platform, but I don't actually know what people need. It has to be driven, particularly if you're looking at something like platform engineering. You have to have a system where you are allowing your users to vote with their feet. And if you find they're not using your platform, then you don't have a sulk. You go, okay, what are we doing wrong? Let's fix that. And that your success metric really is, do people like what I'm doing? Rather than
You
just
mean
I've made a whole bunch of code.
you don't get the CTO to mandate that the platform must be used for all new code? I agree entirely. I think very strongly, I agree very strongly with your comment that you need to be thinking about the users. I think good platforms should be focused on. I like the way that it's described in team topologies. The job of a platform is to remove cognitive load from a stream-aligned team. So, in order to be able to do that, I think the people that are building the platform really need to understand who their audience is, who their customers are, what it is that they're serving, what the problems that they face are. And again, it's this kind of outside-in approach to design. I had a conversation with Gregor Hope a few months ago, who's working on trying to find better ways of abstracting cloud-based, APIs for Amazon. One of the things that he was saying, he said he thought the best platform services were things where they were solving, part of the business problem that you're dealing with. You might be talking about infrastructural stuff, but you're doing it in the context of solving a particular problem. I want an order database or whatever else it is, and there's something about it that's is related to the problem, makes those more narrowly focused, and then a danger of an explosion of lots of different platforms like you're talking about. But it seems that it's a different job writing cloud-based API if you're Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, or whoever, than it is if you're doing that inside of your organization. And far too many platforms that I see are trying to make cloud programming simpler for the organization without putting it into the context of the organization, which seems like a crazy thing to do because Google and Amazon and Microsoft have probably got more money and putting more effort into doing that than you are, so they're probably going to be better at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right that there's like to me it seems like with a lot of them there's this kind of hubris of like I've looked at Kubernetes and it's hard. Silly Kubernetes maintainers, I can fix that. I'll just like write the layer of abstraction that they forgot to write. It's like, well, no, there's a reason that layer of abstraction isn't there is because it's a hard problem. And if you try and put in a bunch of opinions on top, they're going to be the wrong opinions and people will fight them. Except, as you say, if you do it in this more narrow context, where in a more narrow context, you're probably going to be able to come up with appropriate opinions for your context.
So one of the things that I wonder about, and I'm not entirely sure that I'm right here, but is that what we're really talking about is just as ever good design. A good platform is good design choices that abstract you away from certain kinds of services that you don't have to care about how they work anymore. And it's no more than that, but that's what all design is for, really. And so putting that into the right sort of context, it's not a technical thing, really, in a sense. It's design level technical. And my bias is that we don't talk about that kind of stuff enough, because it seems to me. But we're all too busy arguing about whether Rust is better than C sharp, and I don't care.
I think as particularly with those internal platforms, I think that design part of it is a huge part of it. And then the other problem that they're solving is just that communication problem and that standardization problem of I have, and I certainly, I used to see this when when I had a team of 100, and we wanted to have a kind of an aligned development approach. And even in a team of 100, we got pretty fragmented, and it was a lot of heavy work and heavy lifting to try and communicate that idea of how we do things. And if you can encode that understanding of how you do things in your platform, and that's the problem that a lot of platforms are trying to solve, is, well, we don't want people doing it this way. We want people doing it that way because it aligns better with our tech stack or security posture or whatever. So instead of trying to like send emails out to people to say, hey, don't use this, that's going to fail. So you encode it in the tools, and then it's more likely to succeed.
If I can quote you back to yourself, one of the other things that you said that kind of resonated strongly with me is simple but is often missed, I think, is that abstraction's a good thing. So I just wondered if you could riff on that for a moment and just explain what you meant.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I think again, this sort of comes a little bit back to perhaps your experiment, that I think we can be really snobby about abstraction, and I think because doing it the old school way is harder, it makes us feel clever, and we want everybody to sort of have to do it that way. And actually, in so many cases, there's not value in that. We actually have better code if we're building on the knowledge of others. And what abstractions are allowing us to do, and what a lot of those platforms are allowing us to do, is build on that knowledge. But of course, that's not always true, which is why that is sort of the fuel that allows us to feed the fire of the snobbery about abstraction, because sometimes abstractions just really aren't better for all sorts of reasons. They
But
leak,
so
they're
that's
slow, they're bloated.
sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
But that's the idea. My tool or service is so great that you must work a little bit hard to use it. It's an interesting problem. That the other part of that, it seems to me, that's problematic. So certainly an argument that I've heard before is that why should we abstract? Because all abstractions are leaky. And I find it hard to imagine what software development is if it's not abstract, it's not the job of abstracting things and just choosing what are good abstractions and what are bad ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, to be honest, I think most abstractions aren't leaky. I think most abstractions do a fairly good job in the vast majority of cases. And if you think, for example, about as a Java developer, I have to think about bytecode because I'm working on the internals of a framework. But for most Java developers, you just don't need to care about the bytecode, and like you really don't need to care about the bytecode, and that is totally fine. And if you ha did need to care about the bytecode, your job would be a lot worse.
I'm going to quote you yourself again, and this may be contradicting what you were just saying, but you said that high level, more abstract programming can be faster, and you quoted mechanical sympathy, which is something that Martin Thompson and I were. An idea that we were playing with a few years ago. So could you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, and I'll sort of like I, the mechanical sympathy is an interesting one, and I always feel a little bit anxious whenever anybody mentions mechanical sympathy, because I have a huge amount of respect for Martin Thompson, and it is, I have no doubt that it is correct, but it also is sort of opposed to a lot of the opinions that I like to hold, because of course multiple things can be true at the same time, and so I really strongly want to believe and do believe that in most cases you don't need mechanical sympathy, and you can very happily coast along at a higher level of the stack, blissfully ignorant of what's underneath, and that will be good enough for you. And then there's a small proportion of cases when you need to go down the stack because you have high performance requirements, and so then you do need to know what's going on underneath. And that doesn't mean you necessarily need to be programming in those lower level languages, but you need to know that, and that's where the mechanical sympathy comes in, is you kind of need to have an intuitive understanding of what's going on and what decisions you make at the high level, what their implications are for the lower level. But then you get into this sort of the counter argument as well. So if you look, for example, at something like Java and C or C++, I think most people would agree, you know, that Java is a much higher level language than C. It's easier to program, that kind of thing. And so most people, I think, might also have an intuitive expectation that C is going to be a lot faster than Java, right? Because, you know, the price you pay for the easiness of Java is that you're slower than in C. Sometimes, for some applications, that is true. But there are a lot of applications, you know, these aren't just like the cherry-picked edge cases. There are a lot of cases where Java is going to be just as fast as C. And there's certainly some cases where Java is going to be faster than C. And I think it comes back again to some of these abstractions that the problems that they're solving are real problems. So we can look at them and go, oh, well, this is so tedious. I don't want this. But actually, it's solving a real problem. So if you think about garbage collection, for example, garbage collection is one of the things that in Java people absolutely love to hate garbage collection. And they're like, oh, my code would run so fast except for that stupid garbage collector. And if only I didn't have the garbage collector, if only I could manage my memory manually. But when you look at C programs, I mean, there's a whole bunch of sort of interesting things here. One is that if you don't have the assistance of garbage collection, you still have to solve that problem of how do I know when my stuff is ready to be deallocated? So you end up writing your own garbage collector. It may be a reference counting garbage collector, but you still end up writing your own. And you know, it's a bit like the thing that you know, the quote of any blank contains within it, you know, half an incomplete buggy implementation of Lisp. It's the same for garbage collectors, you know, that anything that doesn't have garbage collectors ends up, if it's a program of a reasonable complexity, implementing its own. And it's going to be buggy because they've had 20 years in Java to sort out the bugs in the garbage collector. You don't have 20 years to sort out the bugs in your garbage collector. But there's and you know, the bugs is bad, but then there's another thing, which is I think even worse, which is that yours is not necessarily even going to be as performant as the JVM's garbage collector. And that's partly again because they've had 20 years to optimize it, but it's also because some of the things that they can do in the Java garbage collector are actually speeding your program up. Because sorry, did you add, you wanted a, like a detailed lecture on garbage
No,
collection? We asked that question.
absolutely.
Everybody wants a detailed lecture on garbage collection. Because when we, it's a bit like code, right? Like when we think about code, we think, oh, I'm going to spend all my time writing code. But actually, you spend most of your time reading code. And it's the same with memory, right? Like I'm going to spend most of my time collecting, you know, managing my memory and garbage collecting. No, what you spend most of your time doing with the memory is reading it. And the speed at which you can read memory depends on its physical layout in the heap. Because if objects that are used at similar times are physically close to each other, then when they get pulled into the cache lines, they're likely, you're like, you know, if you take object A and pull it into the cache line, if object B is physically close to object A, it will get pulled into the same cache line, which means if you read object B quite shortly after reading object A, it's already there. It's already in the cache. And if you have a cache miss, that is enormously expensive in terms of your execution code. So what garbage collection can do is it can say, well, when these were initially allocated, they ended up kind of at random locations through the heap. But as in the process of doing garbage collection, I'm just going to handily rearrange the stack for the heap for you. And as a result, your program's going to run faster. And of course, garbage collection never gets the credit for that, right? Because you can't, you can measure the time spent in garbage. This comes back to metrics as well. It's very easy to measure what is easiest to measure and come to the wrong conclusion for both people and for code. So with garbage collection, we measure the time spent in garbage collection and go, oh, it's really slowing me down. We don't measure the way the rest of our code ran faster. And so we make the wrong conclusion.
That no, I think that's a really good explanation. And the only thing that I would disagree with you on that, as a fan of the mechanical sympathy idea, is that mechanical sympathy is only for people that are performance nerds. I think it goes further than that. So the idea originally of mechanical sympathy came from Martin being a Formula One fan, and he was quoting Jackie Stewart, a Formula One racing driver, who was once asked the question, do you have to be an engineer in order to be a racing driver? And he said, no, but you have to have mechanical sympathy. You have to understand enough about how the car works to take advantage of it. And I think that's true. And I think that's true at multiple levels of abstraction. And I want to give an example of what I mean. I once consulted with a very large organization who were building a very large system, complicated system, with lots of people involved, and they'd made a decision to use one of the storage mechanisms that Google use, except it wasn't transactional. And so you had 900 people working on this project, and they were using a non-transactional storage mechanism and treating it as though it was transactional. So it meant that any data that you stored, it was just a matter of chance whether your data got stored or not, or whether somebody else was the last one to store something. So that's kind of, you know, I think that's a version of mechanical sympathy. You need to understand enough about what's going on underneath the covers to think about that. And I see that as a problem a lot. So I was never a big fan of... I was never a big fan of relational database style programming. I was interested in different kinds of things, although I did quite a lot of it. But one of the big wins of relational database programming is that it provided a programming model that meant that you could write concurrent systems without worrying about data too much, and that, you know, which version matters and which version is the truth and which is not. It gave you a model for all of that. And one of the ways in which software development has got more complicated is that we've picked technologies that don't have that property anymore. And if you don't know that they don't have that property, you can get into some really quite deep trouble really quite quickly. So understanding enough about what's going on seems to me more than only performance nerds like Martin and me.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, I think mechanical sympathy is really important. And the reason I don't like the idea isn't because I have any doubt that it's correct and necessary. It's just because I want to be in a world where the easiest thing to do is always the right thing to do. And, where you can sort of skate along the surface and have things be always easy. And of course, you know, that's the world I want to live in. It's most of the time not the world in which we actually live.
Yeah. And that gets back to what we were saying earlier about the elegantly simple solutions that don't leak abstractions too much, or at least the ways in which they leak, you don't care about too much. And those are hard to find. But I do agree with you entirely that we should spend more time looking for those kinds of things as part of that goal of raising the bar and raising the level of abstraction. That seems right to me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think sometimes when you do find those, it's just the best thing. And so they're so valuable that it's worth investing in finding them, because then you get the thing that it's like easier to use and it's faster and the abstraction doesn't leak. And that's just winning all around.
Yeah. I years ago, I worked on a researchy project that was building a very object-oriented platform for essentially writing microservices, these little independent units of behavior. And this was pre-XML. So we invented something called the semantic data service, which was a tag data format that would allow us similar properties to XML. And the programming, it was written in C++, and the programming model was a little bit ugly and a little bit unpleasant, but worked. And so I wrote this beautiful, I thought it was beautiful anyway, C++ model of how to use this XML-like language to build messages. And it was much easier to write the messages and much more natural to do. And then the way that my abstraction leaked was that it performed like a dog. It was absolutely deathly slow. So it's incredibly hard to do this kind of thing. But I do think it's I would agree with you, I think, which is that I do think we ought to be striving to try and achieve it at least.
Yeah, no, I
Sorry.
just think so. Yeah, I was just thinking again about, you know, that sort of that another example of like when that isn't true, and you know, when the sort of the simple pleasant code is actually higher performant is, you know, Brian Getz talks about this all the time in the context of the JIT,
Yeah.
that if you write, you know, your really fancy code that you thought in your head without actually measuring it, you know, is going to be more performant, because you thought you had mechanical sympathy and you actually had, you
Yeah.
know, mechanical antipathy, or, you know, and often what will happen is the JIT will look at that code and go, ooh, I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah.
I'll just leave this alone. Whereas if you write really normal, boring code, the JIT will be
Yeah.
like,
Yeah.
yep. It's a bit like LLMs, actually. You know, if your use
Yeah.
case is normal, the tooling will be like, yep, got this. I know exactly what to do with this. I'm going to give you really, you know, I'm going to compile this really
Yeah.
effectively. And so then you go faster with your normal boring code than you did with your, you know,
Yeah.
handcrafted, weird,
And
supposedly tuned code.
then you can beat C with Java. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So changing tack a little bit. So you're obviously a very technical person, and you've had a an impressive you have a, an impressive CV in terms of the things that you've been involved with. So how did you get started? How did you know what kind of fired your imagination and got you interested in this?
In terms of, you know, my sort of my career as a whole.
Yeah,
So my background,
just the idea of being a software developer, I suppose.
yeah, my background is in physics, which is actually the case, I think, for a lot of software engineers, or at least, you know, certainly
Yeah.
not a majority, but, you know, and what I found was that every time I had sort of, you know, a physics thing to do, I would try and turn it into a software problem. So, you know, I was sort of working on my thesis and I needed to have some visualizations. And instead of going, oh, well, I was like, I know, I can write something to do the visualizations on a sphere. And then, you know, and at this point, you know, I should have stopped. And instead I was like, oh, I know, I can, you know, do ray tracing so that, you know, and I can have lighting effects on the sphere. And it was about paths on a sphere. And it was like, I can make the path have a slight curvature, and then I can do the light effects on the curvature of the, like, the path. And at this point, like, I'd gone way past, you know, any kind of physical implications, but it was fun. And eventually I thought, like, rather than always, you know, sort of trying to, like, struggle to, you know, squeeze something programming into something else, I was like, wait a minute, there is a career called software engineering. I could do
Yeah.
this all day, every day. And which was actually, of course, naive, because I had forgotten about meetings when I was thinking that I could
Yeah.
do all day, every day. But, you know, my dream was that I would do it all day, every day, and get paid for it. And I think, I mean, we are so lucky as a career, because so much of what we do, especially if we're doing it, you know, right in the right organization, it's fun. It's something that, you know, we would do for fun otherwise if we weren't getting paid for it, which just makes us really, really lucky.
Yeah, I'm with you entirely. I feel enormously privileged that I ended up having a career doing what started out as my hobby. I was
Yeah.
playing with computers as my hobby,
Yeah,
and
completely.
I spent my life doing that really. So
Yeah.
that you mentioning fun though gets us into another one of your talks where you were talking about the importance of fun. And that resonated strongly with me. As a consultant, I've kind of got these little rules of thumb that I use to try and understand where an organization is. And one of my rules is how much fun are they having? You know, are they laughing? Are they joking with each other? Are they playful? Because that seems to be a characteristic of good software development to me.
Yeah, and it sort of ties in really nicely to what we were just talking about, actually, which is, you know, this idea that, because I think intuitively we think, well, you know, we're not at work to have fun, and, you know, if we're having fun, then, you know, we must be performing worse. But actually, in general, as you say, there's this correlation between having fun and finding work enjoyable and the performance of the organization. So it's this double win where you get the two good things, and which is kind of amazing. And it's so true, though. I was I was years ago, I was sort of working with a remote team and they were in South Africa. So I was, trying to attend like calls on a phone and the phone line was terrible and I could not understand. And, it's a whole bunch of people clustered around a bad handset and you could not understand a single thing that they were saying on these, status meetings. And so then I had to sort of report back to my management of like, well, how's this, how are the team doing? And it was like, honestly, I have no idea. I couldn't understand a single word. But I could hear them laughing on the call. So I knew that the project was in pretty good shape because I knew if nothing was working and they were behind, they would have been, sort of glum and not laughing. And because they were happy, it was like, yeah, project's in good shape.
It's such an important marker, and as you say, it seems to me that humans are at their most creative when they're playful, and ours is a very creative discipline. But it does matter. It matters a lot. What's the time? I think we're probably coming close to time in terms of our conversation. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't talked about that we ought to? Any topics that you think we should have covered and we didn't?
Think so, no. I mean, I could go on talking all day, but
I've got one because I confess, I hadn't come across Quarkus and I heard you talk about it and you mentioned it today as well. And I didn't really understand what it was and what it was doing for me. So could you explain a little bit about what's Quarkus and why it's so good?
yeah, so Quarkus. What Quarkus does is, so Quarkus is a Java framework, by which I mean it's a collection of libraries to solve the sort of, things that you're likely to need to solve in a Java application. So Hibernate, a REST endpoints, all, security, all of those kind of things. And what Quarkus does and what, any Java framework does is it integrates them. But what Quarkus does, which is it's really the sort of the part of the new breed of Java frameworks, and I think it's probably the most successful of the new breed of Java frameworks. What Quarkus does is challenge that assumption that we need to be dynamic, and so it takes a whole bunch of processing that has traditionally been, so what almost every framework does, so as what almost every library framework, so something like Hibernate, does is it relies hugely on reflection under the covers. So, for example, with Hibernate, it will try and automatically bind to your transaction implementation. There's 129 possible transaction implementations. So, what Hibernate does under the covers is when you're starting your application, it will say, let me try and reflectively load the most common one. Let me try and reflectively load the second most common one. And it goes through this, hopefully, you're in the top, but if not, it goes down 129, throwing a class not found exception every time. And it's the same thing with database support, for example. It has, hundreds of classes relating to every database that get loaded. And so, realistically, this is solving a problem that does not exist because when was the last time you in runtime said, I'm just going to swap out my behavior, my database at runtime without recompiling my application? That just doesn't happen. And so what we said was, what if, or rather what the Quarkus team said, I wasn't there at the time, is what if we move all of these checks to build time? If we move these checks to build time, we don't have to do them reflectively. So our memory footprint is much smaller. Our startup time is much smaller. And another thing which I think is really unexpected, because normally in software, we're sort of accustomed to this trade-off, right? Of like, you can have small footprint or you can have fast. You can have fast startup or you can have fast execution. And the thing that I think maybe they weren't even necessarily expecting with Quarkus is that throughput is way, way higher with Quarkus than with other things. So again, it's like this double win, except it's a triple win. Where it, because you've eliminated a whole bunch of this reflection and just this sort of cruft, and that was keeping the JIT busy, and the dispatching had to be slow because there was all this, cruft in there, then. And also because it's got a reactive core. So it's fundamentally asynchronous inside, even though as a user, we don't necessarily see any of that asynchronous programming unless you want to. With those two things, you get the really high throughput. And so then you end up with this sort of framework. And because we have this idea of offline reflection, so we have a library that supports offline reflection, which allows all of that, those checks that otherwise would be done at runtime, to be done offline. But then you get sort of this extra follow on, which is there's a whole bunch of programming model improvements that you could make if you wanted to any library. But you don't do them because instinctively, with the mechanical sympathy idea, you know that, well, if I did this, it would have to use reflection. It would be such a performance drag. I'm just not going to do it. If you move reflection offline to build time, then all of a sudden that unlocks all of those performance or those usability improvements as well. So, like, there's a whole bunch of boilerplate that you can get rid of. And so then it means that then, you've kind of got like this quadruple win where it's faster. And the developer experience is way, way better than with the alternatives. And so, I mean, I love Quarkus because it's a great product, but I also love it just because that it aligns really nicely with my worldview in which these things are possible to have your cake and eat it too.
That's great. That's a nice description. I must look into it. I'm sorry I haven't before, but I haven't had a project that I needed it for, I suppose is the problem. I don't write enough code these days.
Yeah.
That's my trouble. But yeah, no,
Too many
that
meetings.
sounds really interesting. Too many meetings. Yeah. I think we probably have come to the end of our time. So let me just say thank you to everybody for watching or listening. Thank you, Holly, so much for coming and giving us the benefit of your expertise and opinions on what it takes to build great software today. It's been really, really fun. I've enjoyed myself. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.